What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast number 195, Bicep Tendonitis, a case study approach. This week, our guests are Mike McKinney and Josh Ogden. We just spent like 20 minutes trying to figure out Skype because Skype always updates at unfortunate times. So we are running just a little bit behind, but hopefully we can go right through it. Quickly, I got to ask a question. If I type in tendonitis, sometimes it says with the O and sometimes Google corrects it to the I. So Josh, how do you spell tendonitis?
I spell it with an I.
Mike?
I spell with an I too.
Okay, so I'm probably spelling it wrong when I put T-E-N-D-O-N-I, because, I mean, that makes sense, right? Tendon is with an O, but... Okay, so I'm going to go with it. I've been typing it in wrong sometimes. All right, so bicep tendonitis, case study approach. I am Jeremy Jackson, your host. Right beside me, we've got...
Cooper.
Joshua.
Juanita.
Nicholas.
Tiana.
And all my other kids doing all the other jobs. Mariana is on Twitter, so using hashtag DSMB. You can ask your questions there, or if you're logged in on the live stream, which Juanita, who is that again?
Carlos Presas, Israel Montano, Jason, and Jacob Puente.
All right, and then Jacob is Josh's friend, so he may be jumping in there to bother Josh some. So if you see somebody giving him a wet willy, then that's who that is. All right, we're going to get started right away. Cooper.
Mike McKinney, why did you choose athletic training?
So one of the things I was, I guess I'm like a lot of athletic trainers, is that I played a lot of sports growing up. I played hockey for 20 years in the college, and it's something that I spent a lot of time in the athletic trainer's room and realized that this was something I wanted to do to help people. I'd originally started going down a path towards physical therapy, but then I had some mentors that were athletic trainers that introduced me to the profession, and I really went down that route. And I also really liked the population I was working with. So that's really what kind of drove me towards athletic training.
Okay.
And Josh, why did you choose athletic training?
I grew up playing sports really poorly. My dad was a coach, so I basically grew up in the field house, grew up wanting to go into the healthcare profession. And when I went to college, I actually started as an athletic training major with the intention of being a pre-med major. And I realized in my first semester that I had no intention of ever working in an office with an 8-to-5 job. And I like the constantly changing environment. I like the population I get to work with. And that's kind of what led me into athletic training and kept me here.
All right. So just a quick brief history for Mike and Josh there. So I don't think I introduced you properly. Mike is at Northeastern University in Boston, so 6.5 years there, master's. We've talked to him several different times, and I have a list of the show notes. I think it's episode 135, 130, it's down way at the bottom. Let me see. It was episode 136, 125, and 123 where we've talked to Mike, and then Josh joined us for the last two of those, talking about PRI, postural restoration, or normalizing breathing. And so all that also comes into play here. Josh is a assistant director of athletic training at Baylor University, 8.5 years, coming up on 9, graduating from TCU. That's where you get his man, bear, frog from. So again, you got a little bit of their story, and we're going to get right to what we're talking about today, the tendonitis, which is apparently spelled with an I instead of an O in tendon. We have a girl, a volleyball girl, 17-year-old female volleyball player. She's pretty good. She's like a scholarship athlete, playing club and alternating between club and school seasons, only playing volleyball. She got pain in the front of her shoulder. So we go through normal muscle evaluation, you know, the normal test, that kind of thing. So then I do the speeds test, and I do Jurgensen's. And so,
Jackson, what's a Jurgensen's test?
All right, so Jurgensen's, where you're having the arm bent at 90 degrees, you're causing distraction or pulling downward on the humerus and making them resist internal and external rotation. That's correct, right, guys?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. And then, so we have pain with both of those. So we kind of decide it's bicep tendonitis. That's right where she's hurting. And then we start with... heat, range of motion exercise, well, rest, heat, range of motion exercises, progress to body weight, where she's just using the weight of her arms to go through those exercises. And then we use the TheraBand to complete those exercises as she gets stronger, return to play in about 4 weeks. And at this point, she's just playing to kind of stay in shape. Obviously, she's a senior, done with the regular volleyball season, so We're just trying to make sure she's healthy to go on to the next level. So at this point, I want to see what you guys might have done differently, what I can incorporate into my evaluation and my rehabs and different things that I probably didn't look at, because as we've talked before, you guys look at things a lot differently than what I have because of your previous experiences. So, somebody started off typing in the show notes. Mike, I think that was you. You talked on Twitter, TriPlanar Performance. Why don't you go ahead and tell us some of what you would do?
So one of the things that I look at, and I think Josh is going to probably reiterate this as well, working with overhead athletes, is volleyball is a unique sport in that they're committing overhead motions while they're in the air. So a lot of the comments that we make, say for baseball, for example, that they need hip mobility to get down the mound for pitchers so they throw a ball appropriately, they don't have shoulder and elbow pain, that doesn't necessarily apply to a volleyball player all the time because they're doing this overhead motion with force in the air. So what that means is instead of looking directly at the pelvis while they're in the air, I'm actually going to go just a little bit higher and look at how these motions are occurring with thoracic mobility. I want to see how her rib cage moves. Now, when we talk about biceps tendonitis, I'm almost always never looking at that as a primary cause. Like, I don't think I can think of the last time where I said that's the only thing wrong with somebody and that's the only thing I treated. Really, I'm going to look at that thoracic mobility. So when we talk about hip mobility for overhead athletes on the ground, I'm looking at thoracic mobility for an overhead athlete that's in the air. And generally what I've found in the past is a lot of athletes lack rib cage mobility, which is going to in turn affect scapular position, which is in turn going to affect how they commit an overhead action. That's pretty much the first place I'm going to look. But when I made that comment that it requires sagittal and frontal plane control at the pelvis and hip, that's where they're taking off. So when they take off the ground, it's them creating an environment for them to succeed once they get in the air. So it's give and take. I mean, primarily when we're looking at the overhead action where their pain's occurring, it's not when they're jumping, it's when they're hitting, but their jumping matters to me as well.
All right, so thoracic mobility, how am I assessing that?
So there's a couple different ways you can assess it. If we take a PRI approach, I can tell you what position your rib cage is in simply by laying somebody on their back supine in hook line and just testing glenohumeral internal rotation. Differences left to right or deficits on both sides can tell me that scapula is not positioned appropriately. So I think we've talked about this in a lot of the breathing stuff that we talked about in our previous podcasts. A lot of people just start cranking on posterior capsule and stretching, but I think Josh will reiterate this. Why don't we back off a second and see if we can reposition them and get that range of motion back? So we're going to look at those things. But that's from a PRI standpoint. You can also test this with some FMS or SFMA-based movements as well if you aren't in PRI. So you can do rotational stability tests from FMS, or you can also do what are called lumbar lock positions with your head over your head and behind your back and just rotating and looking at the differences from side to side. Or standing and doing multi-segmental rotation with SFMA. I'm trained in both of those, so I have a different toolbox for depending on who I'm looking at. And often I kind of use all of it just to make a more complete picture of who I'm looking at.
Kind of add to that another tool that I would use. You could use even just a cheap $5 kilometer from Harbor Freight, top and bottom, measure the angles with trunk flexion, trunk rotation. That can show you some things as well. It doesn't have to be an expensive, clinometer from a medical catalog is running $100 or more. It doesn't have to be that. But if you need hard numbers, you can put hard numbers on it, with that kind of a tool. But I completely agree with Mike. My assessment of thoracic rotation and especially rotation above the T8 level typically comes from a PRI background. I do not have the FMS and SFMA type background that he does. My background is in posture restoration, so I'm going to use some of those techniques. That being said, use the technique that you're taught and that you know.
Yeah, and I think also what we previously talked about assessing breathing, if we know that they have that extended spine with that rib flare while they're in a supine position, you know they're going to be lacking thoracic mobility simply because if those ribs are flared and externally rotated, they're not going to have alternating motion like they don't at their pelvis either.
Okay, so again, I know we've talked about this, and I haven't been through the course, and so a lot of it is still kind of over my head because I haven't had somebody walk through and show me. When you're talking about rib flare, can you describe that a little bit more?
So everybody's kind of seen this athlete. You know, you've got them all over the place. They're really, they don't really have the all the different curves in their spine that our textbooks say should be there. Really, they're extended from their pelvis to their cervical spine, and it's just a big arc. Anteriorly forward rotated pelvis, usually externally rotated on both sides. And as a result, they're kind of like back a little bit. These really pec dominant athletes where you see this, really common in linemen and a lot of football players, you'll see it. Baseball players, you'll see it. My entire hockey team, they all walk through the door like that. So that's generally the positions you'll see.
All right, what else?
A lot of the times you'll see, and again, your volleyball players as well, because think about how they're hitting over the net. They're jumping and they're arcing, they're arching their back and coming over the top. They're going to be extended in that as well. You'll also typically find their necks are pretty toned up on both sides. Like these people have no problems clenching their teeth, and you can see their, you know, their neck musculature. They might complain of tension headaches periodically.
Right. You know, and that's sort of what Mike just touched on with the hitting component. That's one thing I touched on in the show notes, that a lot of times these athletes, especially in the younger stages, don't have good core recruitment and good core engagement in the hitting motion. So they go to jump and they fly open into a ton of extension, and then they try and do the entire spike with their arm. One thing that you really need to focus on in the rehab process for this is actually is core engagement in the jump, in the swing, and in the landing, that a lot of times tends to get overlooked.
Yeah, and I think that gets to like the landing training, which is obviously, and that's not just volleyball specific. Like if you look, and not PRI specific or FMS, if you look at a lot of the ACL prevention programs, especially for females, they focus a lot on landing, controlling your landing, and then going to another athletic movement. And so that's where you'll see that a lot, you know. Ignore PRI for a second. That's already something that we focus a lot on in sports medicine.
All right. So, Josh, you typed in there, you know, a differential diagnosis. Is it really bicep tendonitis? So walk me through some of the ways you rule out some of this other stuff you typed in here, like thoracic outlet or rotator cuff strain or deltoid strain. So walk me through some of the ways that I can look and say, okay, well, it is not this or it is this.
I listed all these things basically off the top of my head that can kind of confound the whole aspect of anterior shoulder pain. The first thing that I came up with that I think has to be ruled out in any kind of overhead athlete, at least in my experience, is thoracic outlet syndrome, more particularly the neurogenic component. You know, your Allen's test, your Atkins test. Check and see, does this athlete have a reproduction in symptoms in these positions? One thing that I see that's really common in pitchers is that they have, you know, they've been told for years they have bicep tendonitis or that they have a rotator cuff issue. And then we finally check them for thoracic outlet type symptoms and, oh, by the way, their hands pasty wide. Or they completely lose feeling in those positions. So I think the first thing you have to rule out is thoracic outlet, because that can masquerade not just the traditional my hand goes numb or my elbow aches, whatever. I have had athletes in the past that have had anterior shoulder pain, initially diagnosed as bicep tendonitis, that eventually had a first rib resection for thoracic outlet syndrome. Other than that, in the front of the shoulder, you know, as you palpate, you've got the supraspinatus tendon that's very close, you've got the anterior deltoid. To some extent, you have the pec major that comes over and attaches on the humerus above the bicep tendon, to where you can actually get friction between the pec major and the bicep tendon, in which case your treatment may not necessarily focus on, you know, strengthening the bicep or strengthening the cuff, but maybe we need to lengthen the pec. If you go back to like Travel and Simon's trigger point work from decades ago, there's a trigger point referral from the infraspinatus that causes pain over the bicep tendon. I've had cases where they have an infiltrator's trigger point referral or tender point, since we really don't have a great definition of what a trigger point is, that they had no scap dyskinesis, they had no weakness, they simply had pain, and we worked the infraspinatus, and the pain went away. I actually had a Kesher with, this is probably 2 years ago, with bilateral bicep tendonitis. He's a PEC for PRI terms, Mike. So, you know, I don't know where your mind's going with the bilateral, you know, with the PEC component. He had not been able to grip his steering wheel in his truck with his right hand for about a year and a half at that point. We did tender point work on the infraspinatus bilaterally, and his pain 2 years later hasn't come back. other than that, you know, scap dyskinesis, right, thoracic rotation.
Slow down to that real quick. You said you did tender point work on the infraspinatus?
Infraspinatus followed up with kind of medial anterior deltoid.
All right, so talk to me just a little bit about that. I mean, I've just started using a lot of manual therapy where I'm doing the, it's an active release type stuff, active ART type stuff. Again, I don't want to be sued for using that word when I'm not really trained, but it's that, that type of therapy. And so, you know, we're really, that's what it sounds like you're doing, but talk to me just a little bit more about that.
That's exactly what I'm doing, is that type of treatment. We have even addressed it with the ISDM type treatment, direct pressure over the tender point, have them go through some kind of motion that, you know, causes a noxious stimuli, go through 8 to 12 reps, rest, repeat with a little more extended type motion. So I may go, if it's infraspinatus, I may go with direct pressure and just start with scap retraction, and then go into more of a row, and finally with external rotation and really engage the muscle. So it really just depends on where I'm working, but that's something that I've treated that is masqueraded as bicep tendonitis. Now, with what Mike was saying with the PRI aspect, there are certain things that he and I are gonna look for. Then down the chain, low trap weakness, serratus weakness, tricep, both of us mentioned that in the show notes, in all caps, I believe. we're gonna look at pelvic stability. All of these things play a part, but in, you know, a direct treatment of the shoulder, you know, the initial thing, the important thing, make the pain go away, and then we rehab to keep it going. So that may be, you know, something I look at initially. Other components would be, you know, scap dyskinesis. If the scap is anterolaterally tipped, by definition, as the humeral head sits in the glenoid, you have to have a compensatory internal rotation that's going to increase, you know, friction across the bicep tendon, especially at its insertion. So that's something to look at. But at the end of the day, all of these are going to come back to rehab components for the posterior chain, for the low trap, the middle trapezius, you know, serratus anterior, tricep, that kind of stuff. Mike, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, and I think, like, going off of that, I think is what we really have to focus on with this sort of thing is, I'll be honest, like, every time I've treated this in the past, I might have done manual therapy with my patients for this for maybe about a whole 10 minutes. And the vast majority of my treatment with them is modifying their lifts and their movement patterns to control their shoulder through motion. And I found that to be more successful. Early in my career, I would do manual therapy only with sometimes people like this, which is not the right thing to do. I'll be the first one to say it, because it's not correcting the problem that would have been there first. One of the things I found is making sure you train, Josh mentioned serratus, but also getting the subscap in there. I think manual therapy can sometimes, especially with athletes, give us access to these muscles and these movements, but then, you know, after that 10 or 15 minutes, we gotta spend the majority of our time reteaching them to move in a different pattern. I think the overhead restrictions where we find biceps tendonitis is when, if that thoracic spine, that rib mobility, is not letting your athlete get back and then come forward to finish, she's fighting against resistance that doesn't necessarily have to be there, and she's repeatedly doing it. I'm gonna be the bad guy and say, I don't think this has anything to do with her playing club. And I think it has nothing to do with that. I think it's honestly a positional issue that she's fighting through it. And then once you address the mobility concerns of the shoulder, usually these problems start to go away. I often find it's hardly just biceps alone, just honestly anterior shoulder pain. It's just the biceps tendon is really sensitive. I think mine's even flared up just sitting here. So, and in a computer-centric world, especially with high school students now with everything, you know, we have to address how they're treating themselves outside of sports. I don't think it's just sport that's causing her a problem. It's just aggravating them.
Right. And kind of what you were saying, the important thing to remember with any kind of manual therapy or really any intervention other than loading of the tissue, it's a neurological input. We can make that pain go away for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 hours, but eventually it's going to come back if we don't address the positional component and the weaknesses that led to it in the first place.
And then we have to give, going off what Josh said, this variability of movement while she's in the air, because sometimes I think we're all guilty of this once in a while. We talk about sports medicine interventions almost like physics 101. Like when you go to a physics class, the first thing they said, assume we're in a vacuum. Okay, well, everything functions a certain way in a vacuum, but you know, in real life and sports, it's not a vacuum. There's a lot of different, there's chaos. And so we have to give this athlete variability so she can respond to not just a typical overhead motion. Maybe the ball gets tipped on its way there and she has to side bend to get it back over. You know, we have to train that variability. And I think sometimes that's where, at least something I've worked really hard to correct in my rehab approach is making sure you add that back in there. And that's movement, that's not manual therapy and motor learning. So we have to prime this athlete to not only learn a new skill, but build off that skill. And sometimes I think that's an ego check for the athlete, especially if it's a really high level athlete. And then you put them in a position that they can't do something that seems simple, they get really frustrated. So it's a lot of give and take. I think that's, you know, going off what Josh said, it's that neural coding, that neuro sequencing. There's a number of things you can do to improve that from just having them do 20 to 30 minutes of aerobic conditioning before you try to teach them a new skill or rehab them. It has nothing to do with, you know, just overall conditioning. It's priming the brain for neuroplasticity. We're starting to see more studies that show that. And that's simply, you know, I think that gets to the point of why do pitchers run? People think they make pitchers just run around the baseball field to keep them out of trouble. But in reality, it's to maintain, I think, neuroplasticity and make that argument.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I want to kind of go back over, check and make sure I'm understanding. Obviously, you know, I'm learning it's not just the bicep tendon, and what you're saying is it's probably not really the bicep tendon at all. It's other things around it, including the bicep tendon. Well, I could almost mean it's all, but so it's other things in the anterior shoulder, but it may be because of thoracic spine tightness or malposition, and that's something we would have to assess and correct. But it also may be with the infraspinatus or subscapularis tightness or weakness, and mm-hmm. that's something we would need to address.
And one of the things that just to add to that, so early in my career when I worked for shoulder surgeons in a physician extender setting, when I would see people with chronic bicep problems come into the clinic, something that they all had in common was they had this inability to control their shoulder through motion. They weren't hypermobile, their capsule was strong, but all these muscles weren't sequenced in doing their job. And basically, as they complete these overhead motions, it's basically continuously banging into this long head of the biceps tendon that's right there anteriorly with the capsule. And it's, you know, and you have that chronic capsular stretching with overhead motions, with swimming, gymnastics, volleyball, it doesn't matter. The biceps tendon starts to become the safe stabilizer to take place of the capsule. So that's why I think that more general approach is the better approach than just working on, you know, giving someone, say, just eccentric bicep curls to train biceps tendonitis. I don't actually think I have prescribed that in a long time for anyone.
All right, so talk a little bit more just about the evaluation, but slow it down for me just a little bit. I mean, you know, I want to try and make sure I catch it all. Just in the evaluation process, what's going to be the first thing you look at? Somebody comes in and complaining of anterior shoulder plane, and we'll start with you, Mike.
So me personally, the first thing I'm going to look at is two things. I'm going to have them on their back, supine, hook line. I'm going to look at glenohumeral internal and external rotation. But prior to that, I'm going to be a good athletic trainer or any healthcare clinician. I'm going to probably talk to this athlete for almost probably 15 to 20 minutes and get a history of what's going on. I want to know what stresses are going on in their life. I want to know what's bothering the sport, what's bothering that lift, what daily activities bother them. Because a lot of times, I find that if I can manage an athlete's stress, diet, sleep, and life outside of, you know, give them tips outside, it's their pain level goes down dramatically. And then I have a better, I have a small, so you start with a target that's the size of, sorry, Josh, the size of Texas. And then I want to make a target that's the size of Rhode Island, because that's what I'm looking for. And if you manage pain before I even touch that shoulder, I have a better idea of what I'm dealing with. But once I get past that and I do my internal, external glenohumeral evaluations, I also do what PRI does is an apical expansion breathing test, because that's just going to tell me very, very subjectively, not objectively, very subjectively how they're moving air within their lungs, because they need thoracic mobility to do that. Ribs have to internally and externally rotate for your lungs to work properly. And you'll find just laying there, if you restrict rib motion on one side while they breathe into the left and on the other side while they breathe into the right, there's a difference. And if just there's a difference, you know you're dealing with a thoracic mobility problem. There's lots of other things, but that's at least where you start in my eyes.
All right, Josh.
I completely agree. The evaluation starts when they walk into the room, meaning I'm going to see as much as I can, obviously, how do they move their arms, how do they rotate their torso, how do they swing their legs when they walk? All of these things are going to play a part in my overall evaluation process. Obviously, start with the subjective history. Find out, like you said, what stress is going on in their life. How long has this been going? How, and to me, it's even important to pay attention to their eyes when you're talking to them. Like, do they look tired? Do they look stressed? That's all going to tell you in big picture terms, how much is this affecting their life? From there, obviously, our palpations, our special tests, things that we were taught in school, I still use a lot of those. But in terms of specific problems, sorry, but a Hawkins Kennedy or a O'Brien's is not exactly that specific. One of the docs I work with puts it, that's one of a million little special tests for the shoulder that really don't tell us anything by themselves. But I try and go through that, get kind of the little more traditional assessment. Then, like Mike, I'll go into the PRI assessment, which obviously the internal external rotation, flexion, abduction, those kind of things are part of a standard eval that we're taught in school. It depends largely on the athlete, whether I do the apical expansion or not. How long have I known them? How comfortable are they, with the athletic training room? I don't try and freak them out at first, because that's going to obviously increase their overall stress level. From there, trunk rotation, for any shoulder problem, I'm checking internal external rotation at the hips, especially the contralateral side, and I'm checking hamstring flexibility or overall tightness. Especially in my work dealing with fishers and with overhead athletes, if they can't internally rotate and flex over their front hip, they're going to have shoulder elbow problems. So that's something that I think is big to look at. For our case scenario with the volleyball player, very important for jumping and landing mechanics. So I'm carrying the eval down at least to the hips.
Yeah, and you have to, and I didn't want to take too much from Josh, but I completely agree with the hip evaluation as well. Because if you're, if you look at a volleyball player, especially a high level, is a volleyball player tall?
She's probably like 5'10".
Okay, so she's got a fairly long torso. So when they jump and they finish that overhead motion, they're actually going into flexion. So if you have this hyperextended athlete that's basically getting to neutral where they finish, their shoulder's taking the beating. So if you introduce flexion back in their life, they feel totally different when they jump, when they throw, when they hit a ball. And with that, you have to have the pelvis involved. If you don't have the pelvis involved and basically have lumbopelvic mechanics in order with your thoracic mechanics, you can't achieve getting into and out of flexion. I think when a lot of people look at PRI, it gets a pretty hard rap because they're like, oh, extension's bad. Extension's not bad. Extension's power. Extension is how our athletes, I need them to complete a task in extension, but I also need them to be able to get out of it and into other positions and transition effectively. When they lose the ability to transition, or you'll start I think you're starting, if you read a lot of neuro articles like we do, this concept of variability in sport, not just with the type of sport, but the actual movements themselves. If they lose the ability to do that within their sport, they're going to be injured. I can promise you that. Like, it's going to happen. Whether it's their shoulder, it's their knee, it's low back pain, it's hard to say. So using the pelvis, checking hamstring length, and even where they're landing on their feet. Look at their landing mechanics. Are they landing on the outsides of both their feet? Do they even know where their heels are? You know, these are all sorts of things that, you know, during a sport, a volleyball player's not jumping with her heels. I understand that. But does she know where her heels are the other 15 hours she's not playing volleyball? So she's basically walking around all day, prepared to defend the net or spike a ball or whatever you, what have you.
Right. And I completely agree. I mean, extension and activation of the posterior chain, this is what we want out of our high-level athletes for sport performance, but they have to then be able to turn this off at the end of the day. And you know, like you said, system variability. If you constantly stay turned on all the time, you're going to have increased tension, you're going to have, you know, increased pain, all the above. You know, and in terms of getting the athlete flexion or getting them neutral, we're going to use the PRI techniques, but there's plenty of other programs out there that focus on posterior pelvic tilting, you know, engagement of the internal obliques and transverse abdominis. You know, I know there's in some circles, you know, the Shirley Sarmons of the world and that kind of thing have been getting kind of a bad rap for movement impairment syndromes, but even the Sarmon exercise program for posterior pelvic tilting, anything to get them out of that kind of extension. You know, a lot of the other things that we're looking for, you know, in terms of internal external rotation of the hips, can they find their arches? You know, if you get them out of that anterior tip type pelvis with whatever techniques you have available, a lot of the other stuff is going to come along for the ride, and then you just have to coach and progress them down the road.
Yeah, and I think this is also where if they're doing any type of lifting program or working outside, especially in the high school setting, if they don't always have a lifting program, football is one of the sports that usually always has something, but a lot of athletes are kind of left to their own devices or have strength coaches outside of it, is to make sure that what's going on matches what you're working with. And I think that's, I mean, I'm fortunate here. I work so closely with my strength staff. We are all one piece. But I think that's an effort athletic trainers actually have to make with, you know, especially external programs and things like that, to make sure that you're completing this athlete's health care. Because strength training is incredibly valuable to reinforce what you're doing in rehab. And I think that's sometimes where strength coaches get a bad rap, is because athletic trainers are like, well, they're just hurting my athletes. I'm like, they might be hurting your athletes because you're not talking to them. And you're not creating a beneficial program, you know, for the athlete, not for yourself. So I think that's another piece to look at as well.
Right. And that's something, I was fortunate to be able to go up to Northeastern in the summer and kind of see how Mike and his staff, you know, integrate. You know, and that's something they do a great job of. They've been trained on the same systems. Say with my strength conditioning coach here with baseball, he has a slightly different background. But we're able to sit down before the year, talk about what are our goals, what do we want? We want, you know, neutral pelvis, we want core engagement, we want low traps, we want serratus, whatever. You know, and then even though he and I might use different specific tools, the end goal is the same, and the approach, we're both working with the exact same goals for our athletes. So that's why I keep mentioning other systems. The specific tool to me is not necessarily as important as having common goals and having a common approach. Yeah. And as long as we're working together for the same outcome, we're working in the best interest and the benefit of our athletes.
Yeah. Jeremy, I had a question for you about this case. Do you have an aerobic training program put together for this athlete?
No. No, she would come in and do the heat and the exercises, and then that was it, because we have her for about 50 minutes during the day, and that's about it. So we'd come in, do the exercises, and again, You know, there's two of us, there's probably 12 kids in there at one time. So it's not like I can stay with that one, but that's normal for athletic trainers, right? So that's not an excuse, but if I want to do better, that's why I'm talking to you. So go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And the reason I'm asking is because I'm not saying you have to, like, be with her every second, but I think that's something that this athlete could benefit from. Because if we're talking about breathing, and we're not even going to go towards PRI. If we give this athlete a higher aerobic capacity, her body position at rest is going to be less sympathetic and less extended. Sometimes that rest state during class or whatever can still be an extension because a couple of reasons. They're in sympathetic tone, okay, so they're already right, they're always ready to play volleyball, but also they don't have the variability of their heart rate and energy systems to allow them to rest. They're always operating, if someone watches the video, they'll see this. They're always operating in kind of a range like this, where aerobic capacity will give them this range. And if they come down here, it's letting their energy systems relax. Not saying this is going to directly fix biceps tendonitis, but what it's going to do is it's going to help her body position from just constantly extended breathing to a more relaxed, you know, lower state of recovery. So I think that's where aerobic conditioning has its place in sports like volleyball that are obviously more anaerobic and explosive and really quick by nature. It's still, I think, necessary from just your body's healing standpoint. And again, the body's primed for motor learning. They're finding a lot with studies looking at stroke recovery and brain injury and things like that, that neuroplasticity is promoted with aerobic activity. So sometimes that's a harder sell for athletes that don't do aerobic activity if they're just a one sport person. But I think that gets them out of that specialization role and broadens the variability within their systems because it's not all orthopedic, not at all. And so I think that's
so So what would that program look like? Should I have her working on the bike? Because if we're running, she's bringing those arms up and slowing them down. Is that not aggravating the anterior shoulder and being counterproductive? So what are your thoughts there? What would that aerobic program look like?
You're absolutely correct. I think that's where, again, I'll defer to you seeing this athlete, an athlete that doesn't necessarily run and you tell them to go run. Well, you have about 20 more problems you got to fix now because you have to fix their running mechanics. So I always say, start on the bike, use a simple heart rate monitor. You don't need anything fancy. And just work on these aerobic efforts for extended, like 25 to 40 minutes, somewhere in there, just making sure that you're getting this athlete just something that's not constantly anaerobic, letting their system relax.
Right. And I'll kind of add on that. If this athlete is not necessarily a runner and she is having anterior shoulder pain, the first thing she's going to do when you say run is to try and lock up to limit that motion. And that's going to lead to the ribcage elevation, scalene tightness, SCM tightness, things that we don't necessarily want in a case of anterior shoulder pain. 100% agree. Bike, I probably wouldn't even start her on a bike with the arm components. I'd just have her on a straight stationary.
And so with that, just having her, you said a 30, 45 minute workout. So would that be just like a solid like that, or should we have her doing the sprint type, the one on, three off, or whatever it is? We're just working up to that.
Yes.
So both of them, mix them up.
I think there needs to be variability.
Okay.
Initially, I would just have them, 20 to 25 minutes steady state. My personal preference would be 60 to 70% heart rate. I don't know what Mike would lean towards.
Yeah, I think sometimes looking somewhere, like we're thinking the average age of our athletes, I think somewhere between anywhere 135 to 155, 160, you're going to get, if a steady state over that 40 minutes, you're going to hit that goal. And then mix it in with, you can do some more higher efforts like 8 minutes max ventilatory threshold, 2 minutes relax or recover on slight spin, and then right back up to 8 minutes on another day, and then working through movement and things like that. But making sure it's consistent, because that can aid rehab incredibly well, especially if they're not able to do their sport, you can benefit them in other ways.
All right. So another thing you guys talked about was core stability in the air. What are some of the things that we would incorporate core stability for an overhead athlete?
Reaching activities. Alternating reaching activities is something that I always like, because what that's going to do is that's going to get their serratus involved, which is going to support them through an overhead motion in the air. Because again, you're taking their pelvis away from them in the air with those ground reaction forces. So a lot of reaching and movement and activation exercises. Personally, they're hard to describe, and I use a lot of PRI-based, and they're kind of like, what's the way to put this? Isometric and muscle-activating exercises with positioning and breathing all in one. And that's a lot of what I use for that. But you can do, actually, sorry, I should have just said this first. A lot of the tall and half kneeling series are fantastic for this, because in order to maintain that body position while you're through those tall and half kneeling progressions, you have to have your scapulas in the right place. You have to have your body in the right place. You can't be shrugging your shoulders. So those are really good activities, I think, for that. And you're taking their feet away from them in tall or, tall kneeling. They're on their knees. So that's much harder than half kneeling, because you have to really keep your ribs down in body position. And, I mean, if you really want to get your core engaged while you're doing more, I hate the word functional exercise, because I don't think anybody can really define that properly. But it is functional. I mean, you're moving a lot of things at once and having to be mindful of that body position.
Yeah, I think my core progression, and like Mike, I use a lot of the PRI type techniques. But a lot of the things that I do rehab-wise, I may use a PRI exercise as a base, but then I'm doing a more traditional I, Y, and T for the shoulder, but doing it in a quadruped position with a hip shift and breathing integration. So I may base a lot on that, but then I kind of progress. I guess my progression would be, depending on the athlete, start, you know, either prone or supine, just working pelvic tilts, core integration with breathing, move them into kind of a quadruped type position first, then I'm going to go into a half kneeling, you know, and whatever exercise is needed based on her specific weaknesses. And again, you know, we defer to you on, you know, having actually seen the athlete and done the eval. You know, maybe they need to work on eccentric shoulder work. Maybe they need to work on, you know, low trap, whatever the exercise is, you know, progressing from prone quadruped into like a half kneeling, you know, ball catch, rotational work, whatever. I'm a huge fan of doing a pull off press with the jump stretch type bands in a half kneeling position. I would say it's Cressy and Reinhold have some great stuff out there about the standing derotational work with a cable crossover. But, you know, I'll progress them as I'm getting them up. I'm going to progress them from, you know, the half kneeling into a standing, but with a max base of support. So spread the feet as far as possible to really limit pelvic rotation from there, and gradually, you know, bring them back into an athletic position as we're working on rotational components. And then, oh, by the way, can we do that with, you know, shoulder flexion and trunk extension while keeping core engagement? You know, and then at that point, I'm comfortable getting them back into a jumping program and overhead hitting program. My thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I think some of the other exercises you can do, a really good one, and this is, you don't even need equipment, you just need a heavy rubber band. And if you put someone in like a half kneeling position, and they're reaching with their left arm to hold this rubber band, nothing on their right arm, and they thoracically rotate to reach with the right arm against that resistance in their left arm, and they're engaging their left abdominal wall. If you want to see someone bury their anterior core musculature in about 2 minutes, that's a really good way to do it, depending on resistance of the band and their body position. If they're not getting any burn out of that, you know their body position's off. All four activities, like Josh mentioned, I prefer that than just laying them on their back and doing crunches and stuff like that. Like respiratory bear crawls and things like that are tough. You need to have body control. As far as working on core musculature for overhead athletes, the other guy to look at is Alan Groover out of Arizona. He works a lot with the Arizona Diamondbacks and has private physical therapy practice down there as well, and does a lot of the baseball integration for PRI, and he's got a wealth of information. Eric Cressy, the other people to look at are Bill Hartman and Robertson up out of Indy Fast in Indianapolis. I would highly recommend you see any videos those guys have to put out, because they're going to integrate a lot of the things we're talking about and give you a visual to put with it. They have a lot of stuff on YouTube and Instagram. I think that would be worth anybody listening to watch and just see what their approaches are.
All right. So you said reaching exercises, you're saying half kneeling. And from what you were just showing in one of them, it's like they're reaching out. Were they reaching to grab something from you or reaching to touch a wall in front of them? Can you explain
that a little bit more? So if they're reaching, if you can see this, so if I'm reaching towards you where my hand is in this, so I'm holding right here a rubber band and my arm back here is not holding anything and I'm in half kneeling. So now I'm going to reach, so resistance on my left hand, and I'm going to reach with that right arm and not shrug, not bring my head in any ridiculous position, but down and forward to use that serratus. And then as I'm coming back, I've got resistance here. So I'm eccentrically opposing this motion and coming back to normal. That's a way to reinforce this thoracic mobility idea while I'm also getting serratus. And you're breathing and timing this as well, because your secondary respiratory function, if you look at the Kendall testing posture and pain, read under serratus, secondary function, respiration. So you need to make sure that you're including breathing with these activities as well. A lot of athletes have put themselves in positions where they're working on core musculature, but their faces are red, they're about to pass out, they're not breathing, they're not getting any benefit out of that.
They're working on necks and hip flexors.
Yeah. Their necks become their abs. So it's like their abs move up here, not where they should be, opposing that rib cage movement. And then the breathing, again, focusing on exhalation. They're gonna inhale. Physics is gonna allow us to inhale so you don't pass out, and your body has obviously protective mechanisms. But if you work on exhaling fully while you're doing these exercises or being in these good positions, you have to engage your internal obliques on both sides, realistically, but one side's just a little bit better than the other, typically, but making sure they both work in unison.
Right, and kind of a progression on the reaching that I like. I'll actually, as I progress them into a half kneeling or a standing, I'll get a TheraBand in each hand and have them get back into their loading position before throw or swing, and work on that initially, and then we're going to switch around and work on the finish position. For a pitcher, I may put them here with their where they reach forward on the throwing side and retract like they're tucking their glove on their front side. And we're going to work the finish position here, and then eventually get them into more of the integrated rotation where they'll have a band in front. With those kind of activities, and make it, and I agree, I hate the term functional training, but make it as functional, as sport specific as I can.
I'm looking behind me because I'm seeing how much room I have in like the screen here, because I want to lay on the floor and show you something. That's, it's really hard for me to explain, but I'll try and explain it first, and then I'll hop. Is it okay if I do that, Jeremy? If
absolutely.
I just hop on the floor back here and show you.
And okay, then, and while you're back there, Josh, if you can kind of explain what he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
After he explains it, just that way
I can
listen.
Try.
Okay, go ahead, Mike.
So what I'm going to go after is a reaching exercise with resistance. So basically you get a lighter resistance, like connected band, and you put it behind your shoulder. So it'd be in my hands. I could go forward. And then I'm going to open up my body with inhalation and exhalation and then reach in a sideline position while using my pelvis to stabilize my upper body. And doing that is going to get... I mean, you might actually see my serratus and my subscap actually cramp on a live podcast, which, by the way, is uncomfortable because that's really hard to strive to get it to shut off. But I did it yesterday, and it wasn't. But for the good of the crowd, I'll do it today. But here, I'll move this chair, and Josh, just tell him what I'm doing.
I'll at least try to tell you guys what he's doing. Okay. So you can imagine him being here, having a band behind his back.
Exhale. Right knee's forward, and then from here, inhaling, and then exhaling, then coming down, starting over.
All right, so what I'm seeing is he's laying like he's cuddling a pillow, kind of, in a sleep.
Right.
So his arms are out for, like you said, about 90 degrees, His hips and knees are both at 90 degrees. And so you have the band you're holding in each hand. You got it behind your back. And then you're letting it up. So the band is actually like assisting you and bringing it up. Then, and that's when you're exhaling on the way up. And then
so I'll keep going.
So you're exhaling on the way up, and then you said breathe while you're there?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're breathing, you're inhaling while you're coming down?
Yeah. So I was wearing a black shirt, so you probably couldn't see what I was doing. When I was at 90 degrees, like my body was a giant 90-degree angle,
mm-hmm.
my next inhalation, the arm that's up in the air, is actually I'm reaching away from my body.
Okay.
With that, against resistance. There's nowhere for your serratus or subscap to go in that position, and that's an incredibly useful exercise. And then as you, I don't know if you could see it, but my right knee was shifted a little bit forward and pushing my left knee into the floor, so I'm stabilizing my pelvis while moving above it and integrating my scapular musculature with breathing and movement. And that's, I mean, that's a high level exercise, but once you get an athlete to that point pain free, it's really good at reinforcing these good scapular mechanics.
Gotcha. Okay, so one thing that you guys mentioned, both of you, was the tricep work. Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the things that I would look at there, and then how am I going to fix it?
The first thing still goes back to positioning. And if you know, if you have the anterolaterally tipped shoulder blade, your triceps in a shortened position is not going to be able to reach its maximal function, right? So in order to get max tricep function, you still have to integrate low trap, serratus, and subscap. I start as basic as just tricep press downs with external rotation, squeezing the low trap, squeezing the shoulder blade here, going to supination with the wrist. Pretty much every shoulder exercise that I do, I try and integrate pronation, supination of the hand and forearm. That's going to alter the sensation of the rehab exercise in the back, whether I'm trying to target the low trap, the serratus, or the tricep. And so if I'm, you know, going into tricep extension and integrate supination with that, I'm going to be able to get a little bit more of a contraction. And no, I don't have EMG studies that prove that, but you can definitely increase the sensation of it. To me, I try and integrate the tricep stuff with the other exercises, especially as I progress them. So like I was talking about with the throwing type stuff, you know, part of the instruction with that is, you know, full tricep contraction. Mike?
You pretty much kind of got after it a little bit. I think there's things you can do with like when you get someone a little bit more pain-free, you can reinforce it with tempo type close grip push-ups, close hand push-ups, where they really have to utilize their triceps. If they have shoulder pain, that might not be possible. But again, some standing positional scapular work because of the influence of the tricep on the scapula with the humerus is, like Josh said, you can't really, with the shoulder, you can't isolate one movement. That's a mistake I made really, really early in my career that I'm glad I've grown beyond that with just experience and looking at more of this information, cadaver studies and things that, and EMG studies, like you can't shut these other muscles off when you're activating the tricep. You just can't. And then, I mean, if you really want to go down the, you know, the movement rabbit hole, you know, you can't incite motion. They've got EMG studies for this. You can't incite motion without the pelvic floor contracting and moving first before you do anything else on your body. I think it's kind of, we got to that first podcast or the second one we did where they asked the question, how do you treat a body without any appendages? And I think it gets back to that is, yeah, we got to start there. But it's really, you got to integrate movements. That's the biggest part. I mean, you can do, there's some good exercises where you're bringing the tricep back in an extension and really kind of bringing it into two separate motions. But in order to get a tricep to do traditional tricep extension, you have to have a good scapular position. So those two work together.
Right. And as part of that, when I was talking earlier about the compensatory glenohumeral internal rotation, if you have the anterolateral tipped scapula, the tricep is part of the whole complex that helps to bring it back into an anatomic position, which is going to take the stress off of the bicep tendon. You know, if we think about the traditional, the peel back slap type mechanism where they get into max ER, and then they have that acceleration phase where the long head of the bicep integrates with the fibers of the labrum. You know, and that contraction tends to detach the labrum from the glenoid. The more they start in an internally rotated position, the more stress they're going to have on that complex. So the more that you can put them back into a, an anatomic type position, the more stress is removed, even though you're getting a little bit of external rotation at the shoulder. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. And another good movement to like really integrate that is, I don't know if you follow Aaron Swanson's webpage, but he just posted like a monthly roundup of articles and a lot of stuff he brings in, which I find very valuable because he does a lot of work for me and saves me a lot of time in finding some of this stuff. But his exercise of the month is a fantastic exercise. I've used a lot, and they've got a really good video of it on there. It's kind of like you put somebody in a bear crawl on all four, then have them do an airplane. So they kind of open up while they're still supporting on that and then coming back down. So it's like a kneeling airplane instead of a standing one. The tricep on the arm you're loading has nowhere to go. Absolutely nowhere to go. So in order to do that, that's another good exercise to do.
And the name again, that was Aaron?
Aaron Swanson. Aaron with two A's.
Aaron Swanson?
It's
just Google Aaron Swanson, the hits, and you'll get enough reading to do for the next 2 years. And I'm not even joking.
No, I came across that last night and decided I'd rather wait and start today.
There's some good stuff in there.
Yeah.
Well, there's always good stuff in there. Valuable information.
All right. Okay, so one thing we didn't, or I didn't kind of get clarification on earlier is you guys were talking about looking all the way down to the hips. You said you checked the internal, external rotation. If, you know, on this girl, I'm looking at the shoulder, you guys said internal, external rotation of the shoulder, laying on the back, you know, and that's some of the stuff you learned in PRI, which I haven't done. And so if I'm continuing down the chain, what are some of the things that I might look for there at the hip?
So one of the things I think that everyone listening needs to realize is that the tests that me and Josh are talking about, you actually do know. So, you know, right, internal and external rotation of glenohumeral joint, we learned that in school. It's right, just the how you're associating it with their body position. The biggest test that we look at the hip is just a modified over test. That's going to give me an idea of what position their pelvis is in. I think you'll hear from a lot of the PRI people is that Frank Ober almost intended that test to be more of a back test than a hip test. But, you know, tests evolve, they turn into what they turn into, and, you know, that's the way it goes. But so we look at that Ober test and see if it's positive or negative, if we're running into bony blocks. In order to get them into a proper position for an Ober test, are they going into extension in their lumbar spine? If someone's in extension in their lumbar spine, just to get them into a proper position for an Ober test, that's a positive Ober test, because they're not getting into a true pelvis neutral, lumbar spine neutral to give you a good idea of what Ober's looking for. And so that'll give you, from there, if you know their pelvis is anteriorly rotated, you can just start looking up the chain and everything's gonna start to reflect the position of the pelvis simply based on that test. And then you can look at deficits. If the pelvis is off in one way or the other, you can bring them up to a seated position and just look at internal and external rotation asymmetries left to right. And you can make a lot of, you know, really good judgments in rehab based off. It gives you, you can use the, you, so we take a lot of these measurements with a goniometer, but then you can ask people, what do you do with these measurements? And then it's like, I don't know, but I'm just measuring it. Well, but if you look at these measurements and asymmetries, you can actually start to make off the pelvis, you can do something useful with that number and not just look at it and say, that's unfortunate, you know, let's go do something else. So those are the, I mean, if you want to like really kind of just do an easy, I mean, there's a lot more tests we can talk about, like it's a pelvis ascension drop tests and things like that. But I think if you, Josh already alluded to it, look at the asymmetries and hamstring flexibility, straight leg, modified over test, just simply measuring shoulder glenohumeral internal rotation, you can make a lot of really good judgments of that athlete's position based off those three things.
Right. Like you said, the tests that we're talking about are tests that we are taught in school just under different names or under slightly different testing conditions. And you know, if their hamstrings are bilaterally tight, are they bilaterally tight or are they in lumbar extension? Which means they have an anteriorly tipped pelvis. Mm-hmm. And if you have them do a max exhale, you know, do they all of a sudden gain 20 degrees of hamstring flexibility? Then the problem is probably not tight hamstrings, it's up the chain. And really all we're saying is we look at it, we try at least to look at everything as an integrated system and as a human being and not a shoulder.
And if you want to really kind of see that in action with an extended athlete, and maybe not this particular athlete, like if you've got somebody walking around that you know it's like, you know, they just have one spinal curve and it's extension, lay them on their back and just say, I'm going to do a straight leg test. So put them up for a straight leg test, but put a bolster, like a triangle. Do you have any big triangle bolsters?
We have one really big one for like the elevation for ankle, but.
Yeah, so put that under their shoulders, bring their ribs down and their shoulders off the table. And compare that, so you'll take their straight leg measurements before that and then put that bolster underneath their shoulders, take them out of that thoracic extension, take the measurements again and see the differences. I can promise you they're gonna change. They're gonna be different. And that's passive range of motion. That's what the athlete has to work with based on body position. And that's something that's easy, anybody can do that. It's just something to look at and be like, hey, I just took passively spinal extension away from them and their straight leg raise increased. Okay, I need to look at the chain. I need to correct above their pelvis as well as, you know, maybe they have a hamstring issue. I need to correct that too, but this gives you more pieces to that rehab puzzle.
All right. I know we started a little late, and I think, Mike, did you say you had just a little window of time?
Oh, no, I have some time. I'm good for now.
Okay. Go ahead.
We're done with finals, and I have no athletes here, so I can talk until 5 o'clock if you need me to.
Well, I might get in trouble if I talk that long. I have kids be coming in here for too long. Again, like I said, she's back to plan. So, but if I do this again, some of the things that I need to look at are, we've talked about so much I can't even remember now. The spine position, like you just said, if they're extended, and then I know I need to look at that, address that with some pelvis work. We need to look at the, did you say how to test the tricep for?
I didn't really get to how to test it, because, you know, you can just do simple manual muscle testing to see if you're dealing with a deficit there.
Okay.
I just think in a lot of shoulder evals, a lot of people just don't just test simple tricep strength, and it's a big factor in how it moves.
All right, so test the tricep. Is the flexibility of the tricep important there? So, I mean, do you do the overhead, you know, like the towel grab flexibility for the tricep? Do you do that?
Honestly, I work a lot off the SFMA, so really I'm just kind of looking, like if I want to see if they're limited, just kind of go up and over to touch opposite shoulder and then see how they are on the opposite side.
Okay.
And then going into the crass position on both sides, you know, which is kind of like, that's the SFMA and that's the breakdown of the FMS where they just go behind both, you know, the towel. So yeah, I think you're on the right track with that.
Yeah. I actually don't typically measure the flexibility of the tricep, but that is something I should be doing. Because I typically don't.
I think it's just honestly day-to-day variability. I mean, we're starting to see more that FMS scores they vary day-to-day. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That just gives you an idea of where that person is that day. So maybe this volleyball athlete will come in and be like, oh, sweet, they got it. Cool, let's focus some other things. Maybe they have a test, social issue, boyfriend or girlfriend breaks up with them, and then they come in the next day, and all of a sudden they're stuck here. Okay, well, we need to work on that. So I think that's where those tests are valuable.
All right. And then we also said working on core stability, and we can address that. You said a lot of reaching exercises, and that's what you showed earlier. And then Josh showed where, you know, with his pictures, he'll have them doing the cocking phase with a band in each hand. So it's resisting because the hands are separating, and then it'll do the opposite where they're coming forward. So that those are good stability, you know, what you guys said, functional but not functional. Sport specific core strengthening type exercises. And then for the thoracic spine mobility, what are we doing there?
That you can do a lot of, there's a lot you can do for that. You can, I mean, PRI is going to approach this from like a rib and shoulder perspective, but if you're not trained in doing that, and there's a lot of techniques, thankfully, with YouTube, you can look at a lot of, the SFMA rolling patterns, if you look at those, that requires body segment disassociation. So sometimes you can use these rolling patterns to reinforce thoracic mobility, but those are incredibly difficult. I even have a hard time doing them myself. But sometimes it's fun for athletes to roll around on the floor and it's actually helping them. So that's something to look into. but simply working on, usually it's all positions where you're on all fours, and like putting your arm behind your head and rotating to like your maximum and breathing in that position, coming back, then doing the other side, you know, things like that nature. Because in order to do that, you have to have thoracic mobility and core strength. So you're working on kind of two birds with one stone there.
Yeah, Mike, you beat me to that. I was going to suggest the all four, you know, with the rotation and breathing. That's something we do as part of our warm up.
Oh, it's awesome.
For our throwing athletes. Some other stuff you might look at would be the original strength with the rolling patterns and crawling patterns and that kind of thing. It's a really, really short book, really easy read, and really immediately applicable. But even just rocking patterns, rolling patterns, those will help with thoracic mobility too.
And if you want to add a breathing component into a lat stretch, so have them, so say if I'm stretching my right rib cage, I'm going to reach up, hold a door frame, step back with my right leg, and then rotate towards my right arm. You're going to feel a massive stretch down your right side. That's feeling like, I always had it described to me like beef jerky trying to separate. Like that's what it feels like. But and just breathe in that position, and it should open up some of that stored tone in the rib cage that'll allow that thoracic mobility to occur. It's not really a stretch so much. I don't want it to be that. I just describe it as that's the position a lot of people know it as, but I actually want it to be kind of an active breathing position. You're holding a position, but you're breathing in that position, not just hanging out until you feel a stretch.
And again, those are like maximal breaths, like breathing as deep as you can and then letting out as much as you can?
More exhaling as much as you can and just breathing, inhaling comfortably.
Gotcha.
Focus on the exhalation.
Okay. So let's go back through some of the resources you guys mentioned. You know, I wrote down Aaron Swanson, and then Mike, you listed off like four or five people in a row that were really good resources, YouTube or whatever. Go back through some of those. I'm going to try and write some of them down, but that way they're also thrown out there again.
All right. So I'm just going to do this off the top of my head. So we got Aaron Swanson. Another good one that we follow a lot is Seth Oberst, O-B-E-R-S-T. He puts a really good blog together that has a lot of, I think, approachable information with this sort of thing. Bill Hartman is a fantastic resource with their clinic's called IndyFast. So if you look up IFAST, they actually just started a mentorship program called IFAST University that it's valuable. You have access to these incredibly smart people I've had the liberty to talk to a few times, and the learning experiences are unbelievable. And so the information from those guys on YouTube, Instagram, they have a Facebook page, are really good resources. So you can have, because hey, sometimes we're big vision proponents. You got to see somebody do this instead of me just telling you. So they have that. Zach Couples is another, I know we've said that in the past, in past show notes, but his blog's always also another good resource. And he's all over his YouTube channel demonstrating a lot of these exercises. The Nominalist blog, I know we've mentioned that in the past. Alan Groover, he's out of, again, Arizona. He does a lot. I'm, you know, partial to the Atlanta Hawks and the athletic training and performance staff. They're very movement and neuro-oriented. So Mike Roncarardi, KK Lyles, and Art Horn, those three individuals are big as well in this arena.
Mike Robertson, also at IFAST, I think.
Oh, God, how could I forget? Yeah. Hartman and Robinson, they're in the same building, literally, and they're just, the same company. So.
Lance Goyke, G-O-Y-K-E, I think, is he at IFAST, too?
Yes, he is.
Oh. Michael Mullins, MJMATC, I think, on Twitter.
At MJMATC.
He has great stuff every day.
And if you go through like my Twitter like, retweets and things like that, there's plenty of Mike Mullen in there. So that's a pretty good. And he's got, I think it's Integrated Rehab is the Facebook page that they have too.
Eric Cressy, Miguel Arrigancio, I think both of those guys worked together at Cressy Sports Performance there in Boston.
Yep.
I guess
it's
now
a little bit less than us, yeah.
It's all the same to me, man. there's one other one that
Doug Kijiji used to work with. But Doug and Connor Ryan in New York City are good people to look at. Pat Davidson. How could I forget Pat Davidson? So these are all good people to really give a really good idea from a movement-based perspective on treatment. And this is, and everybody we just listed off, that I, all sorts of credentials. It's not even worth trying to mention what everyone is, because it's everything. There's strength coaches, there's physical therapists, there's athletic trainers. Some are all of the above. Some are just, you know, one of the credentials, but all kind of on the same page.
And I think in that group, the biggest thing is, you know, it's all physical medicine, whether it's strength conditioning or athletic training, or we're all movement junkies. We're all, you know, research junkies. And it's pulling from multiple different areas to make our athletes better.
Oh, and if, and obviously, you know, we're big PRI, I'm a big PRI fan. So, you know, Jen Poulin, James Anderson, Ron Ruska, Mike Cantrell, the Cantrell Center down in Georgia. I mean, huge, huge resources. But also, if anybody wants, listening along, just wants to read a single article that's going to kind of bring it together, just read The Value of Blowing Up a Balloon by Kendall Boyle. I think that's a good place to start, and that might bring everything back into kind of what we were talking about today.
Kendall Boyle?
Yeah, that's... Do you have the spelling off the top of your head, Josh? Let me see if I can...
I think it's K-E-N-B-A-L with one L, B-O-Y-L-E.
Sorry for my typing.
Sorry, I normally have two monitors going in my computer. That was acting up earlier, so...
Yeah, K-Y-N-D-A-L-L, and then Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E. And the article's called The Value of Blowing Up a Balloon. It's in the North American Journal of Sports Physical Therapy. It's a great, great resource for an introduction and a review of, I think, what we've talked about in this podcast and, honestly, the other three I've been involved with.
Cool. One thing I forgot to kind of recap is you guys also said, you're talking about the plasticity, or basically making your body ready to work or to learn, is the extended aerobic workout. So having that athlete do some aerobic component, that'll help open up their chest as well. So I can't forget to do that, even though I only have, you know, just less than an hour with them. It's still good to incorporate. I got to remember to incorporate those as well.
And make that for homework. Like, one of the things, I mean, I still see a lot of athletes as well, and especially with a high injury rate sport like hockey, I'm pretty busy for the most part. So this is something that I don't necessarily sit them and watch them cycle, but I was like, here's your heart rate goal. Here's what I want you to do. And then when they see me, that's when we're doing like manual or really close guided things.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they need to do on their own. And it's just prescribed exercise.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that is pretty much going to wrap it up. Again, I wrote down a lot of what you guys said, even though you just listed them off. I probably misspelled some. I can only type and listen so fast. And so just going back through there, definitely the resources in the show notes. Definitely you can contact Mike on Twitter, which is it's Mick Kenney, M-C-K-E-N-N-E-Y _ATC. So that's Mike McKinney on Twitter. And then Josh Ogden, Man Bear Frog. That's all one word, Man Bear Frog on Twitter. So that's a good way to get a hold of both of them. They're both pretty active on there. Is there a better way to get a hold of you, Mike?
No, it's pretty much. I mean, I've got my email is pretty easy. It's m.mckinney@neu.edu. So, you know, first name dot last, or first initial dot last name. So I'm always happy to answer questions about what I'm doing here with PRI, with hockey, our care model, that sort of stuff. So always happy to help.
All right.
And my email is just josh_ogden@baylor.edu. So any longer form questions, anything like that, always glad to help.
Mm-hmm. All right, very cool. So I don't want to, what's that?
I was just saying, I'm notorious for finding the nearest person that had me take a picture of them doing something that I need an example of and then emailing that. So
that'll work.
Yeah.
All right. So sportshealth.com/SMB, we just announced the newest winner of the gift card. So it's drawn every month using the passwords or the code. And I forgot to write it in. The January code is GHATS because that's coming up. So I think the December code is FOOBAG, FOOBAG. So if you go to sportshealth.com/SMB, you guys can enter to win, get you a little school health gift card. And I know you're not too far from, I don't know how far Boston is from Chicago. So I guess I shouldn't say that. So GHATS.
It's a day and a half when I drove out here.
A day and a half from Boston to Chicago?
Yep, by car. Yep.
Man. All right. So GHETS is the one that sponsors the CEU units. That's the Greater Houston Athletic Trainer Society. And then this summer, I don't know, Josh, maybe you're going to go down to the South Padre Athletic Trainer Seminar. It's down there in South Padre, but I'm going to be broadcasting live there. So, Mike, you're welcome. It's just a lot longer trek for you. So
yeah, hey, I'll be in Austin for New Year's Eve. So
yeah, well, this will be during the summer. So yeah,
but NADA, I'm going to NADA in Baltimore. So
yeah, I'll be at NATA when it's in Houston.
But me too.
Yeah, that's pretty close to me.
I'll probably either be at SPATS or at SWATA this summer.
Yeah,
one of the two.
And we're hosting this summer. We're hosting postural respiration. Mike Cantrell's teaching it. And right now, we also have Cervical Revolution on campus too. So we're also hosting the PRI courses if people are, you know, interested in coming out to the Boston area and attending those.
Cool. And then what was that on Twitter? We had a conversation about it. You guys at NEU are hosting monthly talks for athlete performance.
Yeah. Yep. So right, the one we just did last night was creating the autonomic. The autonomic system and athletic readiness and how we do that and what decisions we make with our treatment plans. But it's just the first in a series of lectures that we're going to start doing monthly, whether they're focusing on aspects of that, readiness, energy system development, plasma volume management, which is a big research interest of mine and that sort of thing. So we're all going to be hosting those that are open to all healthcare professionals locally. And yeah, we think it's a pretty good series. We just started last night.
Pretty cool. And so finding you on Twitter, that'd be a good way to find out about that. But where's the website for that?
We don't have a website exactly for it, but at GoNU Performance. Is where we'll tweet out a lot of those calendared events and the times and how to RSVP for those and let us know you're coming and that sort of thing. But they're open to all healthcare professionals, regardless of credentials. So, and strength coaches, because we think strength coaches are healthcare professionals too here. So.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to a podcast I did one time. Josh, you got anything you'd like to plug out before we close it out?
I don't think so.
All right. Go Bears.
Suck 'em.
Oh, sorry. I'm not from Baylor. All right. So my website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Almost every single Wednesday we're live. Usually it's 12 to 1. Again, Skype was pulling a fast one on us, so we were a little bit late. And then so much knowledge we couldn't cram it in our normal 1 o'clock. End time. So I am PHS Sports Med on Twitter, PHS Sports Med. And for Jeremy, Sports Medicine One Kids, Mike McKinney there at Northeastern University, and Josh Ogden at Baylor University, that is a wrap.